As you will all know, that Buddhism is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, spiritual paths on our planet. And even though it is so ancient, still its teachings are so relevant today that I am surprised at what I have to do as a monk. For example, last September I was invited to Brisbane to give the keynote address at the World Computer Conference. I don't know anything about computers, but nevertheless, I gave the keynote address. And the people who organized it, they came to see me just a couple of weeks ago, and they said, you wouldn't believe this, but they put all the talks on their website, and the one which was downloaded the most was mine. So I out-nerded the nerds. My talk was even more popular. So why is that? How can a monk who knows hardly anything about IT be able to give a talk which is relevant to one of the cutting industries of our world? And it is because this ancient wisdom is very relevant to our modern world. A couple of weeks ago, I gave a keynote in Melbourne, another keynote address, and that was for the Anxiety and Depression Conference. I had to teach everybody how not to be anxious. And someone just asked me, how can you get up and give a talk with no notes, with no preparation, with so many people? Don't you get anxious? No, because as a Buddhist monk, you learn how not to be anxious, no matter what is happening. Once, after 5 years of being a monk in Thailand, I was traveling in a bus in the far northeast of that country. Now, that was a very poor country. That was 32 years ago. And the buses were not well maintained. In fact, they were so poorly looked after that many buses would catch on fire. And it just had happened that last couple of weeks, several buses had caught on fire. And sometimes people didn't have time to escape. They were killed or badly injured. So I was traveling on the bus. I was in the front seat because they always put the monks in the front seat. You know why they put the monks in the front seat of the buses in Thailand? Because they think they've got so much good karma that you can't have a front-end collision. Because the monks in the front and our good karma will protect all the people sitting behind. Do you believe that? I wish Singapore Airlines would believe that. Then they would upgrade me to the front. If anyone knows anyone in SQ, please tell them that if you put the monk in the front, there'd be no conditions. But I was in this bus sitting in the front seat. There was a monk sitting next to me. And somebody shouted out in the back, fire, fire. There was smoke coming out the back of the bus. And all of the people, the driver slammed on the brakes. And the driver, he climbed out the window. Everybody else, they tried to get out as fast as they could. Now, even as a Buddhist monk of our tradition, we're not supposed to get close to girls. We're not supposed to touch them. But this monk, he was out there. It didn't matter who, a girl or a boy, he was out the door. As for me, at that time, I didn't understand Thai. I didn't know what was going on. I hadn't read the newspapers. I didn't know there was a danger of fires. So I just sat there very peacefully. And all the people went out, and those two people were left on the bus, me sitting peacefully, and a man who was looking at the back, and he found out it was just a cigarette. And he told all the people, no worries, no need to be anxious, it's just a cigarette, I'll put it out, you can all come back in the bus. And as the people, far by the front seat, they bowed to me, oh, the great Arahat, the great enlightened one, who has no fear of fire or death, oh, you're such a wonderful monk. It wasn't I didn't have any fear, just I was stupid. I didn't know what was going on. So first of all, make sure you don't confuse stupidity with a lack of anxiety. But how do you overcome anxiety? Ancient teachings for modern times. One of the stories I told at this conference was a true story, an anecdote from my experience in Australia over the last few years. There was one girl who had anxiety attacks, strong panic attacks. If any of you have had those panic attacks or know other people who have suffered from panic attacks, you know how debilitating they are. You can be anywhere, at the office, on the MRT, in the supermarket shopping. When a panic attack comes, you just cannot do anything. You freeze, you sweat, and you're disabled. And it can come at any time. Because of that, it's a huge problem. Chronic anxiety disorders, which manifest as panic attacks. In our modern world, they're getting more and more common. As a Buddhist, we have the answers to that. Answers to a modern problem using ancient wisdom. And to describe what I mean, here's the story. There was a girl studying in Adelaide University. She was suffering panic attacks, anxiety, disorder. She went to her doctor on the campus, referred to a psychologist, I forget which. Psychologist, psychiatrist, couldn't help her at all. She got worse and worse until she was literally bedridden. She was afraid to even get out of the bed, let alone go out of the house. Fortunately, she had a boyfriend, this Australian boy, who was so devoted to her that he cooked for her, washed her, did all of the housework for her while she was debilitated for a couple of months. But of course, you can't stay like that. Fortunately, her uncle was a strong supporter of my monastery. And her uncle said, you should ring Ajahn Brahm. We call it in Australia, dial a monk service. So, she called me. And she said her problem, she had anxiety disorders. And so I had a chance of helping her. So this was my therapy, over the phone, at a distance. First of all, I asked her, what does anxiety feel like? I'm not talking about as an emotion, as a feeling in your body. Because every emotion you have in your mind is also registered somewhere in your body. So I said, where in your body do you feel sensations when you get anxious? She replied, I don't know. So I said, you find out for me and give me a call in 3 or 4 days when you know where the anxiety is located in your body. So 3 or 4 days later, she gave me a call. She said, I can feel it in my chest, just around this area here. It tightens up. I said, great. Now describe that feeling to me. And she said, I can't. I said, give me a call in 3 or 4 days when you can tell me. Now what I was doing here, this was a bit of psychology, which is a monk, you know. I was giving her something to do, and I was giving her a goal, just to find out about these things. But at the same time, I was teaching her to be mindful, to be aware of those sensations, because she had to report back to me. So in a few days, she came back on the phone and she said, I feel this tightness, this pressure. And she gave a very full description of it, because she was sitting in bed, had nothing else to do except feel these very recurrent panic attacks in her life, and she felt it in her body. I said, well done. Now the next thing I want you to do is when you see those panic attacks coming, either yourself or even get your boyfriend to massage that area of the body, to massage it. Now tenderly, kindly, and tell me what happens in 3 or 4 days' time. So she called up in 3 or 4 days' time and said, what happened? She said, oh, when my boyfriend or when I massaged that part of the body, the feeling disappeared. And I said, well, what happened to the panic? And I always remember this moment, she paused. She said, that vanished too. I said, well done. Now you know how to get rid of your panic disorder. Don't try and attack it in the mind, because you won't be able to deal with it. Be mindful, aware of the feelings in your body when you have that panic attack. They'll be located somewhere. And as human beings in our modern age, at least we know how to relax parts of our body. You know, through compassion, through touch compassion, feel that. And when you feel it, and you're kind, that part of the body relaxes, and when the physical manifestation of anxiety goes, so does the emotional cause. She got the message, and this was one of those stories which had a very happy ending. You could even write a movie about it. A couple of weeks later, she was able to be out of bed. She resumed her studies. She had to do really hard work, but she was a smart kid. And she managed to get a first in dentistry. And as for that boy, she married him. And I did the marriage blessing for them. And she was so happy. And that was one of my wonderful feelings. I'd actually saved her life. And of course, that boy helped. And she wanted the both of those men to be there at the most important time of her life, her marriage. She got her life back. Because ancient teachings of mindfulness and compassion work. So I say that to you, if ever you have a lot of problems emotionally, even if it's fear, if you're fearful when you go into an interview for a job, or you're anxious when you have to go and face the boss, or you're really tense when you have to be in front of a microphone to give a talk to people, or even worse, the scariest thing which anybody could do was have an interview on live TV. Because if on live TV you pick your nose, that goes on air. And everybody sees that. So you really have to be very mindful and very relaxed if you're going to go on TV. Now this is how you relax. Any fear which you have, going to see the boss, going to have an interview, going to maybe receive the results of your biopsy from your doctor, it's very scary. Feel it in the body. There is a tension, a tightness somewhere in your body. Take your hand and just stroke it, relax it, massage it. With real kindness, with compassion. The mindfulness of feeling your hand on your own body, the kindness with which you massage, those two have a very powerful combination. Relaxes the body and takes away the emotional block which you have. And thereby, you can be far more effective in your life. One problem which many people face in life has been overcome through simple mindfulness, compassion, the ancient Buddhist teachings. On that conference, I was also talking about depression as well. And unfortunately, we didn't really talk so much about depression 20, 30 years ago. At least I don't remember it when I was growing up. Yeah, there was some people getting depressed. But today, it's a modern disease, even as bad as cancers. And I'm sure there's many people you know who have chronic depression. And you may also know, if you've been listening to some of my talks and other monks who are well informed about modern advances in psychology, you may also know that the British National Health Service, this huge provider of medical care to a whole nation, was it 60, 70 million people? They wanted to find out what is the best way they can use their limited funds to treat this very debilitating disease, which takes many people out of the workforce, which means they can't contribute to the economy, they can't contribute to society. It's a great economic drain, and they wanted to find out how they can deal with this. So, like any good scientific organization, evidence-based, they did research. They researched huge samples of people to trial three different types of therapies for depression. The one was medication, the drugs. The second was what's known as cognitive behavioral therapy, otherwise known as counseling. People in science always like to give things big names. But it basically means talking it over with a good friend. And number three, meditation. They compared the three. Over a long clinical trial, the results were published. And you can read that report, it's there on the internet. They found that medication, the pills, have very limited effect. It's hardly worth it. That really upset the drug companies. But there was a report, it was clear. Counseling did much better. Talking over with a friend or with a professional counselor. That actually was much better. But the best of all, the one which really worked the best, was meditation. That was so much in the lead that the preferred therapy for chronic recurrent depression in the United Kingdom is meditation. An ancient teaching for a modern time. So how does that work? How can just simply sitting on your backside doing nothing help? I know there's an old story someone told me the other day. There's two people in Australia, they were talking to one another. And one said, "Oh, my son is unemployed. He's lost his job." And the other friend said, "What's he doing?" "Actually, he's starting to learn meditation. At least that's better than sitting down and doing nothing." It's actually the same as sitting down and doing nothing, meditation. But it really works. Because what actually is like depression? For those of you who experience depression, you've got no energy, nothing excites you, everything tastes bland, even colours are like pastel, like all the colour, all the life in your existence has all been washed out. So even eating food, it's got no taste. Even listening to music, it's just boring. Nothing grabs you. And so that means you've got nothing to inspire you, to get you going, to be able to give you energy to live your life. That's what it feels like when you're depressed. You're in a mist. Now what most people do when they're depressed, they go fighting it. And because they fight it, it gets worse and worse and worse. So I give them an ancient Buddhist teaching to overcome depression. And it doesn't just overcome depression. This teaching from the Buddha in the Udana 2500 years ago is one of the most brilliant and effective psychology teachings. In fact, I do give talks to psychologists, professionals. And many of them tell me, they say, "Well, yes, we have to go to university. That's where we get our degree, our piece of paper which allows us to practice." But many have actually said this to me. They say, "But we learn all the practical stuff, the stuff which works, from you, Ajahn Brahm." So much of the things which I'm telling you now, modern day psychologists, they actually use in their rooms. And the reason they do this, because my goodness, it's so effective. And the best way of teaching, as many of you know, is like through stories. And this is one of my classic stories. It doesn't come from me, from the Buddha. And it's called the simile of the monster who came into the emperor's palace. So, if you're sitting comfortably, I will tell you the tale. Once upon a time, in a land a long way away, an emperor had left the palace. I think he went to Kongmeng San temple to do some sort of ceremony. But anyway, he was not in the palace. And while he was away, this monster came into his palace. This monster was big, frightening, and it was terrifying. And all the guards who were supposed to be stopping people coming into the palace, they froze in horror. As this ugly, frightening monster strode right into the palace, and he sat on the emperor's chair, on the throne. And at that, the guards, the soldiers, the servants, and even the ministers, they were so upset. "Get out of here! Who do you think you are? You can't sit on our emperor's chair. Get out!" And at those few unkind words, unkind acts, and even unkind thoughts, the monster grew an inch bigger, more frightening, more smelly, and his language got worse. That made them even more upset. They clenched their fists, they made threats, they got out their swords. If you don't get out soon, you'll be in big trouble. Get out! But every unkind word, unkind deed, or unkind thought, the monster just kept on growing bigger, uglier, smellier, and the language got worse from the monster. Now this had been going on a long time. When the emperor came back from the temple, and as soon as he saw the monster, that monster was huge. He was so big he'd take up half this room. And he was so ugly, so frightening. Not even Steven Spielberg, with all the resources of DreamWorks, could conjure up such a frightening monster. And as for the smell, the stink which was coming off this monster, it was so bad that even maggots threw up. They vomited, they were sick. And the language was worse than you'd hear in Australia when they lost a cricket match. A terrible language. But the reason why this man was the emperor was because he was smart, because he was wise. And that was because he spent so much time listening to the Dhamma at Kong Meng San Temple. And he knew exactly what to do. He said to this monster, "Welcome, monster. Oh, thank you so much for dropping in for a visit. Why did you wait so long to visit me? Has anyone got you a cup of tea yet or something to eat?" And at those few kind words, the monster was an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, and his language got better. And all the people in the palace realized their mistake. So what did they do? They started being kind to the monster. Some of them went up to him, "Would you like a cup of tea? We have English breakfast, we have Earl Grey, we have green tea, we have peppermint tea, it's good for your health. Would you like sugar or honey or just have it plain?" Someone else asked, "What would you like to eat? Would you like some durian? Because it was in Singapore after all. Or would you like a pizza?" Now, monster size, of course. A couple of other people gave him a foot massage. Have you ever had a foot massage? Oh, it feels so nice and relaxing, especially if you're a monster with huge feet. Now, that was not what the Buddha said. I made that part up myself. But the rest of it is what the Buddha said. And every time they were kind to the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And soon that monster was back to the size when he first came into the palace. But did they stop being kind? No, of course not. They kept on being kind to the monster until he was so tiny that one more act of compassion and the monster vanished completely away. Now that's in the Udana, in the Pali Tipitaka. When the Buddha told that story, he said, we call that an anger-eating monster. It feeds on ill will. The more anger you give it, the bigger, uglier, smellier, and more offensive it becomes. Depression is an anger-eating monster. Get out of here! You don't belong. I don't want to be depressed. I want to be back to normal. I don't want to be like this. Anger-eating demon. So what should you do? Welcome your depression. Be kind to it. Thank you for coming to visit me. If you're depressed, you have many benefits. You don't have to go to work. People look after you and care for you. They're coming around. People never visited you before for weeks come and visit you. Enjoy your depression. Oh, so wonderful, I can just be here and do nothing. I could sleep late into the morning. You can't do that if you're going to work. So what we're doing when you welcome the depression is something which I know as a meditator happens. Because you're not fighting, you're not wasting your energy. You've got so little energy anyway. With compassion, with kindness and acceptance, a natural healing happens. Energy which is wasted, literally being depressed about being depressed. That energy is not wasted anymore and it starts flowing back into your mind. And the dullness, the mist, the darkness, which is the world of the depressed person, brightens up. The mist lifts. They can start to taste the food again. The colours regain their intensity. Life has more meaning. They're back into the world of the normal human being. Simply because they haven't wasted their energy with negativity and fighting. And indeed, as a meditator, this is what I say is the cause of depression these days. Because I've sometimes wondered, why is it that so many more people are getting depressed these days than before? At least that's what it appears to me. You know why? It's a lot to do with the stress of your modern working life. You work so hard, it's so competitive, it's so hard. You really have to control so much just to get by. Because you expect so much and want so much, you waste so much energy in struggling just to get by. So a lot of times, and I say this to each one of you, most of you are so tired. You know that because every now and again, not every now and again, two or three, four times a year, I teach meditation retreats. And I built a retreat center in Australia, which is again state of the art. State of the art because everybody has their own room. And every room has its own ensuite. It's 5-star. Many people from Singapore have visited that and they said, all you need now is a golf course and then we come and stay. So it's not a golf course, it's a retreat center. But when I teach meditation retreats, this ancient teaching, what's the most important part of meditation? Compassion, kindness. So I tell people when they come, catch up on your sleep. You know, there was one woman, she was an executive from Sydney, who came on a retreat which I gave in that city some years ago, many years ago now. And when she came on my meditation retreat, she came about 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock at night because she was an executive. She had to get everything in order before she could leave the office, and that was till 10, 11 o'clock at night. When she came and saw me in the morning, usually you have to get up early in the morning, 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning. She didn't make it, so she came to apologize after breakfast. And when I heard what she was doing, I said, "Madam, you are sleep deprived. You live such a hectic life. I want you to practice compassion as your meditation. And to start off with, be kind to your body. I give you full permission to sleep as much as you want." And she was so happy that she went straight back to bed and she didn't get up until lunchtime. After getting up at lunchtime, she had a nice lunch, and then she went back to bed again. She did that for 3 days to catch up. After those 3 days, she felt so relaxed, her body was back to normal again, because she had to catch up. And then, the next 3 days, she caught up with all the other meditators. By the end of the 9-day retreat, she was way ahead. She was a star meditator. Why did she do that? Because she realized she was aware and kind enough to her body to give it extra time to sleep. If any of you want to make a new business and make a lot of money for yourself, just get a place where people can catch up on their sleep. A hotel, a resort, but no activities, no tennis courts or swimming. I can't understand why some of you people, you go on holiday and you do so much activity. You know, you go and see the Great Wall, you go and see Venice, you're out there doing so many things every day that when you come back to Singapore, you're so worn out. That's supposed to be your holiday. Why is it when people go on holiday, they can't wait to get back to work? Sometimes even your holidays become so stressful for you. You think you have to do so much. So if you can get, you know, just a nice quiet place somewhere and build comfortable rooms and just lovely beds and tell people no TV. First of all, make sure you can't get SMS messages there. Screen at a place which is black so that no mobile phone coverage reaches that area. Give lovely beds and tell people you can get up whenever you want. You can eat now any time during the day and you can go back to bed again. Relax your body. Be kind to it. You will make a fortune. Wouldn't you want to go to a place like that? Would you? I think many people would. And afterwards they come back, they feel so good, they're relaxed. Number one, they wouldn't get so many health problems. How come you get health problems? It's because you wear out your body. You never give it a rest. So especially with depression, you're struggling, you're fighting the body, you're fighting the world so much that soon you get what we call frustrated. You know, if you had frustration before, you really try hard in your work, in your life, in your marriage, you really try to do the very, very best, and just stupid people, why can't they understand? There comes a time when you give up. Frustration. And very often that leads to depression afterwards. What's the point? You give up putting any energy into your life. Because what's the point? Be careful of that. Because that negativity leads to a lot of depression. So instead of doing that, one can actually, number one, lower your expectations of life, yourself, and each other. We have such high expectations in life. I know that I have to do a lot of marriage counseling as a monk. I don't know why people come and ask me to give them marriage counseling. I've never been married. I'm a monk. But you know why I think they ask me to give marriage counseling? Because I'm cheap. I don't charge. So, when I give marriage counseling, straight away, well, this is one story which I love telling. It was two Thai ladies, two sisters. They came for counseling. They came together. You know, sometimes you want some sort of support, you know, because you're telling personal stuff here. You're telling it to a monk, and sometimes it's a bit scary. So the elder sister came first, and I asked her, what's your problem? Her problem was her husband. You know, she was having a very difficult marriage, and she was trying to solve the problem, but she was really contemplating divorce. And she asked my advice. And you know, we try and make the marriage work. And you can make the marriage work. With good advice, with the right attitude, with wisdom and kindness, you can make anything work. So I gave her that advice. We're not sure whether she wanted to accept it or not. She was still thinking of divorce. But anyway, I tried my best. And then I talked with her sister. You know what her sister's problem was? You know, she was young, she was reasonably attractive, but she couldn't find a partner. Now some of you girls might know that sometimes you find a nice boy, you go out with him for a while, and it doesn't work out. And that happened so often to her. She was really looking for someone to share her life with, you know, a life partner, but she just couldn't find the right guy. So she came and asked me for advice. You know what I said to her? I said, I've got the solution for both of you. You want a husband. Your sister's got a husband she doesn't want. Your sisters? Share! Pass a husband you don't want to your sister who wants one. So I'm making them laugh, the first thing. Then I got serious with them. And I said, look, you've got what we call, what the Buddha would call, husband suffering. There's a certain part of suffering you get when you have a husband. And all you women have that. If you talk, you tell me, yeah, I get the same problem. You know, I get the same problem too. The message should come up to you that husbands, they're all the same. So don't think if I get rid of this one and get a new model, it will be different. They're the same. Because I've talked to people so often and they keep telling me the same things, the same stories. I don't know if there's any counsellors here, but my experience of counselling, when the first person came and told me their marriage problem, I thought that was really interesting. The next person came up, they said the same thing. And the next one, here they go again. You all think that your problems are unique, but they're not. They're shared by everybody. So that's called husband suffering. Now I told this sister, if you get rid of your husband, yes, you won't have that type of suffering anymore. You won't have the suffering of worrying what your husband is doing when he comes home late. You won't have a worry about, you know, trying to sort of deal with husband's emotional baggage and trouble. You won't have that problem anymore. You'll be free of that suffering. But instead, you'll have what your sister has, called single woman suffering. And you, single woman, you know, you want a partner. At the moment you've got single woman suffering. If you find a partner, you won't get rid of your suffering. You'll just have what your sister has now experienced, married suffering. That's why, for those of you who don't know this story, because you know, many people haven't heard me teach before who are in this room, we teach the three rings of marriage. The three rings of marriage. The first ring is the engagement ring. The second ring is the wedding ring. And the third ring is the suffer ring. Why are you laughing? Because it's true, isn't it? So anyway, but if you don't get married, you have suffering. If you get married, you have suffering. Welcome to life. It's not perfect, but you know, it's good enough. So, you know what some people say then? They say, okay, you know, if you have a husband, it's suffering. If you don't have a husband, it's suffering. Single woman is suffering. I'll become a nun. I'll leave the world. And if you become a monk or a nun, what do you have? Ask the monks here. You have monk suffering. I can't do this, I can't do that, never get the food I like, have to keep talking to people, never have any free time. That's called monk suffering. You know, when I was a young monk, I had young monk suffering. I looked at all these senior monks, the abbots. All the abbots, they got these nice rooms they can stay in. They get the best food. And important people come to see you. So when I was a young monk, I wanted to be abbot. Now I'm head monk. Just ask Kuangsheng. We have abbot suffering. He's nodding his head. He knows what I'm talking about. So the point is, whatever you do, you always have some suffering in life.
Ajahn, I just have one question. When we do something like, when we do it, like we enjoy it so much, and we are attached to it, so when we kind of lose it, then we feel very sad when we lose it. So that is called attachment that leads us to suffering. So what does this ancient teaching have take to get rid of that attachment? Thank you.
Okay. There's another way of enjoying life. Because I remember that when I was a young man, I used to love going to concerts. And actually, you may not know this, when I was a young man, my hero was Jimi Hendrix. I loved Jimi Hendrix, and I went to many of his concerts when I was growing up. You know, when I went to a concert, I enjoyed every minute of it. But when the concert was over and the music stopped, did I get upset? Did I suffer? Not at all. When I walked out of a concert hall after the end of a great concert, never once did I feel sad. I never cried after a great performance. I hope many of you have enjoyed the talk this evening. Now don't expect, oh, the talk's over. Oh, it's so sad. No. The meaning of life is to enjoy the moment. And once it's over, let it go. There's another talk coming tomorrow by some other monk or nun. There's another concert coming next week. There's another movie happening. You don't have to cry that the movie is over. There's always another one coming soon. Enjoy. Taste that life. And as soon as you finish the meal, walk away from the restaurant, not with tears, but with a sense of appreciation. How fortunate I was to have been there at this talk. How fortunate I was to be able to enjoy the soccer match or the talk or the movie, whatever else it is. But as soon as it's finished, let it go. That's exactly what I tell people when someone in the family dies. What a wonderful time we've had together. Father, Mother, I just love you so much. The years we've spent together have been some of the most memorable. Thank you so much for being with me. With those sorts of thoughts, like the end of a concert, you walk out from the funeral service, not with tears, with the same feeling as when you walk out from a great concert, feeling blessed. Because that's the feeling I had when my father died when I was only 16. I never felt sadness. I felt how lucky I was to have a father like that for 16 years. What great times we had. What marvelous music. What a great concert. Thank you so much. No tears, but sense of joy and appreciation. That's the Buddhist way of enjoying life. Enjoy it and let it go. Another question?
Hello, Mr. Ajahn Brahm. I have a question for so long.
Okay.
I have a friend. Then I feel that I always help her. But she always say that I didn't help her anything. So what should I do?
Okay, a friend, or you've always helped her, but she says you haven't helped her. Does not matter. You don't help a friend to be appreciated. You just help her for the sake you want to help her. Even if she doesn't appreciate it, if she doesn't acknowledge it, later on she will. And anyway, you know you've helped her, and that's the most wonderful thing.
Okay, thank you.
So hopefully I've helped a lot of people in the last couple of days. Hopefully in my life I've helped a lot of people. But I don't expect you to say thank you. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Here's an ang pao. I don't expect that. What I expect, if I have helped any one of you, if I have really sort of done something to change your life, you are in debt. But don't pay me back. You help someone else.
Okay.
Because that's what my teacher said. Ajahn Chah said, if I've given you Dharma, meaning in life, happiness, don't thank me. He told me, you go and help other people. And if you've helped them, tell them to help someone else. That's the only way you can pay back your debt. Not by thanking me or giving an ang pao, but for you to go and help someone else. That way the gift of Dharma, compassion, help, service, spreads and spreads and spreads ever wider. So don't say thank you to me. You go and help someone else.
Okay. Thanks so much for the enlightenment. I feel that I know what to do next time to teach her or any.
Yeah, just help her.
Okay.
Whatever she says, even if she barks at you, still stroke the dog.
Okay.
Okay.
So due to the time constraint, this will be the last question. Ajahn Brahm, drawing to your story of the two farmers, we are supposed to leave the negativities behind in the office.
Yep.
And not to take it home to talk about. But when we talk about it with someone else, we will feel better, lightened. So how can we reconcile that? We are always welcome, we are always encouraged to talk about our problems with someone else. So please advise.
if you have problems, if you can't let it go yourself, then you have to bother somebody else. Think of your poor partner who has to listen to all your problems. Haven't they got enough problems for themselves? So it's better if you let it go. That is the number one way to go about things. Now the other story I've been telling recently, how many of you got photo albums at home? Do you keep photo albums? Maybe these days, and you've got it on digital or whatever. What photos do you keep in your albums? I've been to people's houses and they've got photos of their graduation. They've got photos of their marriage. They've got photos of when they were in holiday. How many people put photographs of their divorce in their albums? How many people take photographs of when they're in hospital sick with dengue fever? How many people take photographs of when they're doing examinations in school like they are doing this week? We never take photographs of the unpleasant experiences in life. We take photographs of the happy moments. Why is that? So we can open up the photo album. Oh, that's when we got married. Oh, that's when we're on holiday. Oh, that's when you graduated. Oh, that's when we went to see this wonderful talk in Kong Meng San Monastery. You take photographs of happy moments because opening up that photo album brings you so much joy and encourages you. So why is it a photograph album in here? We don't keep the happy photographs, we keep a lot of the painful memories. To me that makes no sense. Your memory, what's in between your ears, keep that like the great photo album of your happy memories. The beautiful times you've had together. The wonderful experiences you've had in your life so far. Then depression will never affect you. You'll be highly motivated, a happy person. You'll be always focusing on the good bricks in the wall. You'll be able to enjoy the day, the moment, and then let it go, knowing there'll be another good day coming tomorrow. So that thing, that's what we should do. The negative memories, instead of sharing them with someone else, get rid of them even before you share them with someone else. And you know, I've noticed this in most people's lives, the happy memories you have, the happy moments you have in your day are far more in number than the unpleasant ones. It's just the unpleasant ones stick out. They stick out so much like just two bad bricks in the wall of 998, which means that's all we remember. We go back home and we tell our wife, our husband, about our two bad bricks. Please tell her about the 998 good bricks as well. That way, she'll be so happy to see you when you get home. She won't go, oh, here he comes again. What's he going to complain about today? Doesn't he know how much I've been through today and it's so hard? Okay, it's good to share with each other. But how about sharing happy memories and happy times? And that is the way to have happy marriage. So, hopefully you've had a happy ending to today. A nice talk in Kong Meng San Monastery, improving your life, smiling a lot, learning how to overcome modern day problems with ancient wisdoms. Oh, what a wonderful day it's been today. So go back home and tell your partner, oh, what a great day it's been today. And they said, where have you been? I've been to Kong Meng San Monastery. Oh, can I come next time? Yes! Okay, thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Venerable, for answering all the questions.